So this chapter, Fundamentals of Vedanta, I'm not going to go into much details of the chapter, some ideas and then additional, but I would recommend everybody read it on your own at home. I'm only going to cover very brief portions of it, but it very much clarifies all the concepts of Vedanta that we have been discussing the past few months. They have all put them all together in this one chapter. But I'll just cover some of the highlights and then some additional ideas that I got from reading this. And then later on, I would recommend everybody to read it. So what is Vedanta? Vedanta comes from the Vedas. The Vedas, the root is vid or knowledge. And Vedas are the knowledge, and it is ancient. It does not owe this, what they call as Hinduism or Sanatana Dharma. We do not owe our existence or origin to one prophet or one teacher, but it was a series of teachers over thousands of years who shared this knowledge, and it is said that this knowledge they heard in their meditation. That's why it's called Shruti. Heard, and they heard it in their meditation, and then from the totality, and then they then transferred it to their students when they came out of their meditation. The students memorized and passed on to their students, and so on and so on. That's why in my mission, the guru shishya, the teacher student relationship, and where the student then becomes a teacher and teaches her or his student like that. So the Vedas consist of three portions. The first is the mantras, which talk about nature and praise nature and the beauty of nature and see God in all this majesty of the mountains and the sunrise and the trees and the rivers and flowers, bees, birds, all that. The second portion are the prayers or rituals which are offered to please God or to come closer to God. And the third portion is called Vedanta. Anta means the end. Anta also means the goal. So the goal of the first two is to reach the highest knowledge of who am I. So seeing God everywhere and then worshipping God purifies the mind, reduces my vasanas, my selfishness. And such a mind is ready to get this knowledge, which is the Vedas. So, and what is the role of prophets? So in the Gita, the fourth chapter, which we have just started just this past week, Lord Sri Krishna says that whenever I am needed, whenever the goodness is on the decline and the evil is rising, it could be good people are suffering and evil people are prospering, or good ideas are suffering and wrong ideas are coming up. He says, I come again and again. So when Krishna says I, what he means is I, that total consciousness. He has identified with that. And that's what we believe, that all the prophets that came over the centuries, whether it was Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Guru Nanak or Shankaracharya and all of those who came, were meant to revive religion, to revive the spirituality. And as I said, even on Saturday, they appeared in different parts of the world, so the language was different and the student was different, so the level of teaching was geared to the student, so it appears different, but in reality the teaching is all of one, and the language is different, you know, the rituals were different, as we talked on Saturday. So there is one God, and the prophets are the one that bring his message. Even his is, we use traditionally, we talked about that on Saturday. God is this consciousness or Om, which is beyond male or female. It's not male, it's not female. Just as electricity, is it male electricity or female electricity? It's neither. It is the energy which illumines the bulb, the fan, the heater, the air conditioner. So God is the energy consciousness that illumines us and is beyond both male and female. Has no form, shape, color, no description. But all these forms that we use are easy for the mind to relate to, whether it's Jesus on the cross or Guru Nanak or Krishna or Ram. But in reality, the form should lead you to the formless. Otherwise, if you get stuck on the form, then you become fanatic that this form alone is real. But the form has to lead you to the formless and ultimately has to lead you to I am, that to the I within. As long as you're looking at God outside, it's good. You know, you are a devotee of God and you are loving God, and that's very good. You have a relationship. But ultimately, that God that is in everybody is my own higher being, is the goal. So that's what they say. Right now, our attention is on all the sub-objects, you know, the people, the things, my possessions, my job, my power, my position. But spirituality takes you to the subject. Who is the knower? Who is the one that is knowing? Right now, I'm focused on objects, emotions, and thoughts as my body, mind, and intellect. But we have to turn our attention to Om, the knower. So the knower is this consciousness that knows everything, knows my vastness, knows my body, mind, intellect, knows my thoughts, knows the objects, emotions, and thoughts. So from the known, we have to go to the knower. And that is the goal of spirituality. Who is it or what is it that knows? And that's why there's a book called Drig Drishya Vivek, where it says the objects are known by the eyes, seen by the eyes. The eyes is known by the mind. But who knows the mind? That is the ultimate knower. And who is the one in whose presence the body, mind, and intellect are functioning? That is. So there are three paths. One is knowing, one is feeling, and one is willing. So knowing, you know, we know so much. And we go out and read, and we surf the net, and we go to college and learn, and then we get this MD or PhD or master's or, you know, engineering and law and all those. But that when that same energy for knowing is turned towards the self, towards spirituality, that becomes the path of knowledge. So the Gyan Marg or the path of knowledge is the same energy which is directed towards knowing the world is to turn towards knowing the self, knowing who I am. Then the second is the path of feeling, path of emotions, path of love. And again, it's the same thing. All our energy is spent in loving people, which is good. There's nothing wrong with that. But that same love has to be then transferred to God, who is the ultimate source of love everywhere. Everything is that expression of that divinity. When I love my child, or when I love my spouse or my beloved, I am seeing God. That is the highest love, if we can do that. And then willing is the path of action, where in the world I act with values, practicing right values of dharma, righteousness, honesty, truthfulness. And then those same values, when they are transferred into the spiritual realm, then they become. So that is the path of knowledge, Gyan Marg, bhakti or path of devotion, and path of karma. So these three paths all lead us to that one goal. That's why they say with the body you should serve, with the mind you should love, and with the intellect you should know. But we get caught in this ego, this perceiver, feeler, and thinker, and that becomes our goal. And the ego thrives on possessions. I have this, I have that. And it just wants to acquire more and more and more and more. And the more I acquire, the more I possess, the fatter the ego becomes. And the ego can be either of material possessions, can be of physical, you know, beauty, or it can be of physical strength. I can climb Mount Everest. Or it can be financial, or it can even be of knowledge. You know, I know so much. And the highest, subtlest ego is the spiritual ego, that I am holier than thou. So one has to be very watchful when the ego arises, because right away when somebody praises, you feel a little bloated, and then somebody criticizes and says, you know, that was the worst class I ever attended, then immediately you feel what was. So one has to be very careful. Ego can be both ways. It can be from too much success or too much failure. I am so great, or I am useless. I am nobody. Nobody cares for me. Nobody loves me. Nobody likes me. So that is a negative ego, but that also is an ego. Ego of goodness or the ego of hopelessness. Both have to be watched out for. And death, that's what the ego fears the most, is death. You know, because what is death? Death is when this body is given up, then everything I hold dear is, I have to give up all my near and dear ones, and my house, and my dog, and my cat, and my position, and all the, everything. And that's why people are so afraid of death. But the Gita says death is just a change of clothes. Death is not something to be afraid of. It's to be accepted. In fact, there is a famous song. He says, Zindagi ki sham a tujhe gale lagau main. He says, because this girl knows she's going to die because she has been condemned to death. And she sings and she says, let death come, let me embrace it. Because it is just a part of change. Whatever is born has to go. So one should welcome death as much as one should welcome birth. Death and birth are just both two sides of the same coin. If you welcome death, birth, you should welcome death too. So the willingness to give up, and ultimately spirituality is what? Is the death of the ego. When the individuality who thinks I am special is given up, and that alone is functioning through me, then that is the death of the ego, where there is no perceiver, feeler and thinker, there is no knower, no feeler, no thinker, but everything is that one. Talking about death, this employee goes to his employer and he says, well, you know, what is the company policy? Can we have some time off if there's a death in the family? So boss says, it depends. You know, what do you mean depends? So depends on what? He says, depends whose death. He says, what do you mean, whose death? Boss says, your death.
Oh.
If it's your death, you can have time.
Permanently.
Permanently. So death is the ultimate, but death is not the ultimate. The ultimate goal of life is to go beyond death, to realize that I am that supreme consciousness. I was never born and I never die. That's the message of the Gita. I was never born. Yes, this body appeared on this particular date and this month. That's my birthday. But that is the birth of this body. But I, the consciousness, na jayate mriyate va kadachit. In the Gita, right in the second chapter, the first teaching of the Lord is that you are never born and you never die. So what is going to die is this body, which is destined to die, which there is no escaping it. Has there anybody been in history who didn't die? Whether it was Jesus, whether it was Muhammad, whether it was Guru Nanak, even Ram and Krishna. As long as the consciousness has taken this human body, it is bound to be given up. So if we stay in the ego, then we remain in tension, stress. Oh, this thing is happening. Oh, that thing is happening. This person didn't smile at me. This person didn't talk to me nicely. The stock market is going down, or my house is getting old. Or my body is getting old. You know, my face is getting old. So all those, that is tension. So they say from tension, switch to expansion. And what is expansion? That there is one reality that has taken different forms, and everything is an expression of that. So once this person has that, then even inanimate objects are respected. Even a thing that is not alive is respected, because everything is God. I think I might have told you that story, but there was this young man who came to see this monk, and he had walked for miles. This was in the old days. It was hot, and he came and he was exhausted, and And then the monk was sitting there, and he just walked, and he was so tired, he threw his shoes on one side, just kicked them, and then he ran to the master and bowed down and said, "I'm here to seek knowledge. I've walked for miles." And the master says, "Get out. Get out. Yes, get out of here. I came here because I'm unhappy. I'm suffering." He said, "Yeah, but the shoes that brought you here, all these miles you walked, see how you have disrespected them? You have one shoe have thrown here, one." So the point is that it has to start from that God is in everything. If you can't respect your shoes that have carried you all these hours, then where are you going to get knowledge? So the point is that whoever has helped us in our spiritual journey is our bridge. That's why the importance of guru. The word guru means, gu means ignorance, and ru means one who removes. So one who removes ignorance of science or of chemistry or of golf or of tennis or of mountain climbing are all teachers, but one who removes the ignorance of who I am is called the guru. So that is the role of guru. Guru is the bridge, that just as we need a bridge to cross a river, so to cross this ocean of samsara, that's why this world is called an ocean. Why? Because it is vast. The world is huge, and then it drowns us, in the sense it holds us, it binds us, because we get so fascinated. I'm unable to get out, just as when you're trying to cross a river or a large body of water. If you don't know how to swim, you know, you will fall down and drown. So similarly, this world is compared to an ocean, which first of all, ocean, we don't know where it ends, the other end is. And secondly, it's so deep. So similarly, this world, is all its fascinations are endless. And I am caught, I'm drowning in this ocean, in all my ignorance, in all my attachments. My attachments are like weights that are holding me down, just as you're trying to swim, but you have a heavy backpack and you have heavy shoes, then you can't swim. So you have to throw everything overboard. That's why even when a ship is sinking, they throw stuff overboard. So I have to throw all my attachments if I'm able to swim to that shore of oneness with everybody. And ultimately, one has to go within. That's what Jesus even said, the kingdom of God lies within. So the point is that the truth, the honesty, the sincerity lies within. And maybe the five sheets I'll do next week, because it's a longer topic. We'll skip that, but we'll just go to the next one. This, I think, because this particular chapter will continue for 2 weeks. So just as a bulb has no energy of its own, the bulb is inert. Bulb has no light, but when the electricity flows through it, then the bulb is illumined. And what is illumined in the bulb? It's the filament. The bulb has a filament. When it is lit, when the electricity runs through the filament, then the bulb lights up the whole room. The whole room is lit up. So similarly, this body is like the bulb. The mind and intellect is like the filament. So this is called the gross body. This is called the subtle body, the mind and intellect. And consciousness is the electricity. So this consciousness, even though it is everywhere, consciousness is everywhere. But then why does the chair not get up, you know, and walk out? Okay, oh, I'm bored of this lecture. The chair doesn't do that. A human being can. Why? Because human, even a dog or a cat won't understand, you know, what we are saying, or a plant won't understand. Even though life is in them, consciousness is in them, but they do not know who I am, what is my nature. They don't sit down and discriminate between right and wrong, real and unreal, permanent and temporary. So why? Because the subtle body is the mind and intellect, which has the capability of reflecting this consciousness. Even though this consciousness is everywhere, but humans are best blessed with a mind and intellect. Animals also have a mind. They also have emotions like love and all, but their intellect is not that developed. Dog, of course, as we grow up into the evolutionary chain, maybe chimpanzees or dolphins have a slightly more developed intellect than, say, a frog. But ultimately, they also do not sit down and discuss who am I, what is my goal in life, what is my purpose in life. So we have to constantly pay attention to the electricity, the energy that is illumining and that is giving me the ability. And in meditation, we go beyond the cross body, we relax the body, then we watch the breath, then we quieten the mind, because the mind is where this consciousness is reflected. But when the mind becomes still and there are no thoughts, then that consciousness alone is, and that time even the body awareness goes away and the awareness of who am I. I mean, it's not easy. Probably yogis and great meditators would be able to do that. But even for us, when there are moments of stillness, when the mind becomes still and the body becomes still, you do feel that inner energy, that inner joy. So that is the goal of meditation. And they say a lamp does not need another lamp. You know, when a lamp is lit, the lamp can illumine the room. We do not need another lamp to see the lamp. The lamp is self-luminous. So similarly, the self, this consciousness, is self-luminous. And the intellect cannot know it, cannot illumine it. You cannot say, I want to intellectually know God. You can't. When the intellect gives up, see, the intellect, as long as it says, I want to know God, know God, know God, you can't. When the intellect ultimately becomes still, then in that stillness, when the intellect finally gives up, the example they give is of the pole vaulter. The pole vaulter, you know, uses the pole to jump way up. And then when he has to cross the stick, he drops the pole and then goes on the other side. So similarly, so the stick brought him to that height of 20 feet or, I don't know, 25 foot, whatever feet they jump to. But then ultimately he has to drop that stick to go to the other side. So the intellect is the stick. The knowledge is the stick that brings us to that reality. But ultimately even that knowledge, the intellect, has to be given up. And then alone, as long as you are intellectually trying to intellectualize God as a concept, you will fail. So that's why God has to be known as my own nature, not somebody separate from me. So that understanding. And what is the ego? Ego is a bundle of past memories, past accomplishments. You know, I have done this, I have done that, I know this, I know that, I am this, I am that. So whatever is in your past, when you're living in the past, that is ego. And that is the one that has to be given up, because ultimately whatever I have, my possessions, my knowledge, are a gift from the Lord, from that reality. And so that understanding. And the last concept is sunlight in the room. Of course, now there is no sunlight, but in the daytime, when the sun is shining brilliantly outside, illumining the entire solar system, it is also illumining this room. If you are sitting in this room and the light is coming through the window and you see this beam of light and say, oh, this room is lit up. But the room is a very limited expression of that. When you break the walls, then you realize there is one sun everywhere. So similarly, in you and me, there is this consciousness which we have limited as my consciousness, your consciousness, just as we say my room, your room. But when the walls of the room are broken, then there is only one light, one sunlight, one consciousness. So similarly, when the walls of our ego are broken, we don't necessarily have to drop the body. Because some people think realization can be only after death. Realization is realizing that you are infinite and you are one. So that is the goal of spirituality. There are a few more concepts in this chapter, including the five sheaths and the four aspects of the inner personality, which we'll do next week. Any questions, any comments?
Go ahead. No, you go ahead, because mine's a little off topic. Go ahead.
How do you stop yourself from thinking about God intellectually when in your everyday life you have to kind of use your intellect to
yes.
Live life? Like, it seems like you have to keep going in and out.
Right.
And since if you're living your life and you're not becoming like a devotee and living in like a temple or something, like, it seems like it would be really hard to do that, to separate it that
right.
way.
No, definitely the path of devotion is very important. So we are not saying that you stop intellectually thinking about God. The more you think about God with love, the closer you will get. And that is good. And that is very good. We are not saying that one should not love God or serve God.
Yeah.
Or one should not read the books or the scriptures. Yes, all those are necessary. But ultimately, they can only take you so far. Ultimately, you have to realize your oneness with God. And that is what the scriptures tell us. And then God and I are not separate, which is the same on the path of love also. Like saints like Mirabai and all the other great saints of the West, they gave up their ego and became one with God. So you start out by separating, or you can be serving God, or you can be loving God or knowing God. But ultimately becoming one is where that all those three merge into that. So it does not mean that all these great teachers stopped worshipping God or loving God. They did. He continued to, you know, do prayers. Shankaracharya was another great teacher, Vedantin, and he, whichever temple he went to, he composed hymns in praise of that particular deity. But inside he knew that there is only one, and these are not multiple. And I am an expression of that. So that is what it's meant. We're not saying that, no, loving God is very good and knowing about God and serving God is very nice, but ultimately the knower, the intellect, has to get tired. When the intellect gets tired and says, I no longer can know it, that's when you know it. But the intellect is the pole that will take you there. But ultimately, even the idea that this pole has brought me, so he doesn't hold on to the pole. Oh, my dear pole, it brought me all this way. And now, no, the pole. So similarly, we have so much love for our intellect that we want. So that's why in meditation we say, still your thoughts. When the mind becomes still, when the intellect is not thinking, not judging, the mind is not feeling, the body is not moving, in that silence you experience that. That's what we mean. You must know God. You must intellectually know him or her, emotionally love, and with the body serve. So yes, keep doing that. No matter how long it takes, you keep on doing those things. But in your silence of the meditation, there should be no thoughts at that time. That is the idea. At that time, the intellect has no role. The emotions have no role, and the body has no role in that stillness. I think that's what I meant. Intellect is the only way to know God. There is no, like for that pole vaulter, the pole is the only way to go that high. So intellect is the only way to know God. We cannot know God without the intellect. But then don't get stuck on intellectual achievements. You know, I know so much. I've written books. I can give talks. I can teach. You know, all that. Then the intellect becomes an obstacle in the path. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So
artificial intelligence, I'm kind of curious, I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Is it really artificial, or is it just a new form of intelligence that everything's got?
I think it's just advanced computers. Computers are becoming more and more sophisticated, but ultimately the programmer has to be a human. I don't know if eventually they will they create themselves.
They're creating their own programs now.
Right.
So they're thinking for themselves and evolving.
But I don't know if they will take over the world, in all this science fiction they talk about. Ultimately, I think a human is required, or we don't need any more humans for computers. They can create themselves.
They're creating their own programming and their own modes of thinking, but that got implemented by someone else. But
right.
I mean, can they actually? I don't know. I mean, look at how everything's automated now.
Right.
But does it have to plug into the wall to get electricity?
Yes.
Right.
Maybe. It's not inert, but at some point, because all that stuff is, there's computers that run the electric grid, so at some point a computer might be smart enough how to figure out to tell those little automatic robots to plug the plug back in, you know, so.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or they may generate their own electricity.
Yeah,
they might have a little solar cell or an atomic cell in it, like a little small nuclear. No.
That's kind of what you're asking. Right?
That's what I kind of want to
ask.
No,
they can't be conscious.
In that too. So maybe.
No, I don't think they cannot be conscious. Mm-hmm. They will still be inert. Mm-hmm. It will still be inert. It will have the intelligence, ability to compute, but. Yeah.
We don't know. This is always, everything changes though. So it's evolution. So we don't really, at this time, I'd say no, but yeah. There was a series that had androids that actually all of a sudden became awakened. And they realized they had a sense of their own autonomy. So, but who knows?
And I think there has to be a God or a creator. I don't think they can substitute God.
Because they were created, and then they were created by people who created by God. So
right.
In some essence,
and then they were creating their own offsprings. You mean?
Yeah. So they were actually able to reproduce.
Right.
Even with humans, some of them. So it's just
but
science fiction
that way.
It's fine.
No, it's a good question.
Yeah, it's good. Made everybody think.
We don't know. Like, there's going to be. At some point, we know humanity is probably going to end, right? And things, you don't know what's going to happen after that in a different world, so that could be a different expression of life, potentially. I don't know.
Come back as computers.
Hi.
Watch The Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems kind of scary.
Yeah, but even if there's a nuclear war and humanity ends, it is a very small part, you know.
We'll be reborn
somewhere else, because it's like this whole solar system. The sun is like one grain of sand in this whole beach. There's billions of stars, like ours.
Well, even if the whole universe goes away,
it's like on the beach. If one grain of sand is picked up and thrown across the street in the park, does it make any difference to the beach? No. So we are like that one, not even that one grain of sand. The sun is one grain of sand. We are a very, very tiny part. And in that tiny part, there is Earth. And then in the Earth is California. Then in California, there's Bakersfield. And in Bakersfield, I am this one little thing. And we are so self-important. Oh, wow, without me, nothing works. So to the totality, it will make no difference, even if there's a nuclear war and the whole Earth gets destroyed. Just a grain of sand. That's all. This whole universe is just a grain of sand. This whole solar system. So we can take ourselves too importantly. When I told that to my nephew, he says, "Yeah, you should come and teach this to all the executives in Silicon Valley." Because he works for Google. He says, "Yeah, they walk around like they are so self-important." He said, "That's a very good point."
Well, it's some point, you know, everyone gets their karma, right?
Right.
Because we're not.
Right. Anything else?
It's not going to happen.
No,
I
don't.
Yeah, in our life, you don't have to worry. No.
We'll destroy ourselves before that.
Right. I'm concentrating on this one.
I think ultimately we have to focus on where am I and where am I going. You know, what is going to happen to the world, or what is going to happen to the universe, or what is going to happen to Trump, or what is. We get so caught up in all these things.
Well, that's another thing. Part of ego could be future, too.
Right.
And that's the whole thing when they talk about staying in the present moment.
Yes.
Helps you transcend ego.
Right.
When you're purely present.
Right. Yeah, ego and then hope. That is the future. Yeah. So ego is the past and hope is the future. But they are both, you're right. That is ego, too. Past or future. So staying in the now.
And we get so attached to our ideas about the future.
But I know you do need some of that ego to improve, maybe not improve, but move yourself forward into the future so you don't become stagnant.
Right. But say people have this wrong idea that people who are spiritual are stagnant. They don't grow. In fact, they actually work better because the doer is not there. There is no doer, feeler, or knower. It is the consciousness working. And they actually accomplish a lot more than you and I. Look at the life of Swami Chinmayananda or Shankaracharya or Jesus or Buddha. Even in their short life, how much they accomplished. So yes, no, we are not saying that one shouldn't work, one shouldn't succeed, one shouldn't work hard. But I should, A, remember that it is God who has given me everything, so have gratitude every morning, get up at night. And secondly, who is that is doing everything? And that has to be the goal of life. While I'm working, while I'm accomplishing, while I'm being successful in the executive world or business world or wherever I am. But constant remembrance of what my true nature is.
Yeah, I think I meant more as you have to have that ego to take care of yourself, your family, your kids. Like
yes.
If you don't have that motivation to have a good life for you.
True.
You know, that you need a little bit of it to keep going.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, human birth, once you have, it is your duty to take care of your parents, your children, your family, and doing all that. So, because the family is a way to evolve, because then I learn to share. If I'm an only child, then I'm not used to sharing. But if I have a brother and sister, so same way if I have a spouse and then I have children, so it teaches me to share and grow. So the householder's life is a way to evolve. Just as a monk's life is one way to evolve, another way is through a householder's life, where I work, do my best, but dedicate it all to God. We're not saying that you shouldn't work hard or be successful or be rich, or, but the doer has to become less. The I, that's what, by ego what we mean is this I, this limited I has to become less. I still work, obviously, but I work as a servant of God rather than as I myself.
Met this lady, she said, oh, I'm doing this for my children, so when I'm old, they will take care of me. And every day I hear that now I'm 60, and I am old now, and I expect my son to do this for me. And I just laugh at a 60-year-old. Why? I brought him up, and I told him all these things, and I'm old, he has to take care of me. Guess what's happening? I know. She thinks she's old.
Yeah, and
my parents also need to be taken care of, and they're both turning 80 this winter, and they're vital,
right.
So Wow.
And you know the expectation, that's what you have, that I'm taking care of my children, so when they're old, when I'm old, they take care of
and
me.
That's being attached to the fruits.
Yeah,
right.
Care, yeah.
Exactly.
And you do whatever you're doing, God, you're doing your duty. God's given you this to do, and with a full heart, this dedication, just do it. And don't expect the children to take care of you, or don't expect anything. Don't expect the results.
Right, right.
And that's what
do your duty, right?
Yeah. And this is what you
and then he'll take care of you.
Why does she need to be taken care of at 60?
At 60, right. My parents lived independently till they were 90 years old.
Yeah.
They lived in their own apartment.
I mean, it's one of the things she really needed, or she got
right.
So you still can't expect it. You don't know what your child's going to do.
Right.
Or did she
right.
have like, healthcare problems and needed to be taken care of?
No, because she made herself since her 60th birthday, she did, my shoulder aches. Oh,
you know what? Now I'm old. And I just
laughed my head off. And I said, talking to somebody older than you. I said, I'm older than you. But you know what? You're all right. But yeah. Because I don't expect my children to take care of me.
Right. Thank you.